From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Like Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the program, a Milwaukee woman hopes her son's injury at the hands of a texting driver spurs action.
Every time I see someone texting and still driving after all of the work that we're doing, after all of our efforts, how can they still be doing this, you know? And that just encourages me to keep going and keep up the fight and keep up the struggle.
Plus, a local author unpicks the knot of the cycle of abuse through a fictional character.
You are not meant to forgive her. You are meant to learn how this could happen. How could a woman become someone who could burn her child with cigarettes?
And we'll chat on stage with the members of the alt-country pioneers, Old 97s. Lake Effect comes your way next, after the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. Thanks so much for tuning in today. Texting while driving is a growing danger on our roads, even though Wisconsin has had distracted driving laws in effect since December 2010. The issue is getting renewed attention of late. Governor Scott Walker proclaimed the month of September as Don't Text and Drive Awareness Month. And a new national campaign has gone viral in recent weeks. You may have seen the commercials or the documentary they're based on, From One Second to the Next, directed by acclaimed documentarian Werner Herzog.
The lady who hit X was texting. Texting. Her head was in her lap. She never even saw X in front of her. She actually came straight through the stop sign. There were no brake marks, no skid marks at all.
That's Milwaukee mother Valetta Bradford speaking in the documentary. Her son, 8-year-old Xavier Davis Bilbo, a.k.a. X, was struck by a driver who was texting 3 years ago next month. X sounds like a normal third grader.
Hi, I go to Gensling and I like to play games. I like to do art. I like to go outside to the park and I like to go out places.
But his life is anything but normal now. Mom Bradford sat down with Lake Effect Stephanie Lecce in their home and told her family's story, starting with the day X was injured.
It was a normal day. It was 70 degrees in Milwaukee on an October day. There wasn't a kid in the neighborhood inside the house, and how could I do that to mine as well? So I allowed them to go to the park across the street, and Ari, my daughter at that time, was 13. She said, well, we're going to go pick my friend up who lives on the other side of the playground, and then we're going to go out and play. I'm like, okay, fine. Of course, they've done it 1,000 times before across the street. She's 13, he's 5, almost taller than her at that time, and they cross the street on our side of the playground, no problem. They cross the street on the other side of the playground, going to her friend's house, and on the other side of the playground, a woman blew the stop sign, four-way stop sign in a school zone, blew up that sign, and her head was in her lap texting. So she hit X on the wrong side of the street and drug him back to the side of the street where he started from, about 40, 50 feet away. There's no brake marks, nothing that she even stopped at all.
What happened to Xavier?
When she hit X, she paralyzed him. She dissipated a part of his spinal cord. So she missed his brainstem, they say, by maybe a quarter of an inch, if not even that much. He is paralyzed from the diaphragm down. As you see, he's trach vented, so he is on life support. They did everything they could to try to make those nerves work, but the lung just doesn't do it on its own. Still has the use of his hands, but his hands have some dysplasia, so they're kind of closed, but not closed all the way. So he eats with his hands, his arms still move. He's pretty active mentally, cognitively. We still have all of X here. He goes to school with the nurses, and X is pretty smart. He's above a lot of third graders in his class. He's actually in a class that's actually third and fourth graders, which is kind of it's a college preparatory class already in the third and fourth grade. So, you know, boy, has time changed since we were in elementary school. So cognitively, he is above and surpassing. And he got hit not even a month all the way into K-5. So it took us that first year to play catch up again. The 2 years from after that have been going a lot better, a lot better. And we just continue to try to keep the use of the hands, to keep the motor skills strong. You know, there's a lot of finger exercises that we do several times a day. I make him stop doing whatever he's doing and flex his fingers, press his hands against the other hands, everything to keep him, to keep that, what we have, to keep what we have.
Does Xavier remember the accident? Does he understand what happened to him?
He does now. He still has nightmares at times, you know. When he woke up from his coma and he was kind of really, when by the time that he got really coherent, he was very questioning, you know, why did she hit me? You know, I crossed the street the way you taught me to. I had my scooter on my shoulder. I was holding Ari's hand. Why did she hit me? And as a matter of fact, his scooter pretty much saved his life. His scooter, even though she did as much damage as she did, the scooter caught a huge amount of the blow.
He easily could have been killed.
Yes, easily. And the docs say also that his size and his height also saved him, because the grill from the truck, were whatever hit first, if he would have been the size of an average five-year-old, X is pretty tall, as you can see, if he was the height of an average five-year-old, he probably would have been decapitated.
Do you know what the driver was texting when she hit X and Ari?
I'm told that the text is, I'm on my way. You know, I'm asked the question often. You know, I'm asked, do you know what they were texting? Do you know what was said? I don't know why that becomes important to people, but it's burnt in our memory, you know, from the time that we were told that that's what she was doing. We actually found out at the accident scene that that's what she was doing. We had no idea. We thought maybe she just didn't see him, you know. And a family member, a boyfriend, significant other, or something of that such came to the accident site and was screaming and yelling, I know that's what you were doing, and you're doing it all the time. I'm always telling you, and now, look, you've probably killed these people's baby. And, you know, it was a horrific scene. It was, you know, we're on the ground with X, family members, paramedics. You know, my cousin who was at the accident scene lives a couple of doors down. She's got Ari, and she's screaming. And my father and my brother showed up, and of course they're losing it. So now the police are there, and the paramedics and the fire department, and me just trying to close out everybody except for X is down on my knees, on my belly, talking to him. Mama's right here, and at that time he had been unconscious twice, you know, and them trying to be extremely careful in getting him together, to move him, to get him to Children's Hospital. Immediately, they pulled us into an imaging room, a consultation room, and sat us down. And I've got a medical background, and I'm looking at the films, and when they showed me the MRI, the first thing that I said, and I didn't mean to blurt it out like I did, but the thing that I said out loud was, oh my gosh, you might as well have killed him.
What happened to the driver?
My understanding is that there were two citations issued. One of them being because the vehicle was not registered to that person's name, and the other being something about a moving violation, but the tickets came out to like $170, $179, something like that. And there was no texting law in Wisconsin at that time yet.
So that's it? It was a $100-some-odd fine?
That's it.
What do you make of that? What does that say to you?
It infuriates me a little bit more. and it makes me struggle harder to do what it is that I do. It keeps me more on my toes about the educating part. It makes me understand that, you know, somewhere in Congress, somebody has to be listening, somebody has to be paying attention, that my five-year-old's life is worth $179. And that whether that person knows it or not, that person is part of our daily lives.
Have you heard from the driver since the accident?
The night of, and not again since. And at this point, I'm going to say we don't want to, because I don't see taking him through that. I mean, that person's had 3 years in October.
When Wisconsin finally did get a texting and driving law, what did that mean to you?
I was happy, but I needed to know that those laws were going to be enforced. I've pulled up next to cops and saw them texting, so, you know, I need to know that the law is going to be enforced.
How did your family come to be part of this It Can Wait campaign, including this recent documentary by Werner Herzog?
Well, I initially, 2 years ago, I said, you know, something has got to change about all of this. Something has got to stop. We initially did a visual kind of thing the first year after X got hurt at the scene of the accident. The second year, we did the X-Men event, which we do right here on 10th Street for awareness and education. We'll be doing the same rally again this year as well. And then I started by guest speaking at my daughter's driver's ed class. And then I started speaking at other high schools because the other driver's ed teachers were inviting me. And it just went from there. And then AT&T heard about me, and initially they had called me to ask me for information to the driver, because they were going a different way. And I said, I have no clue. And the young lady from AT&T, he said, who was doing the recruiting for the film, I guess, said, well, can I talk to you? And she had watched the DOT documentary that we did a few months after X was home. And she said, you know, can I just talk to you? And I said, sure. I talked to her. And she said, I'm going to talk to Werner. I think we need to change our minds on which way we're going with this. Then Werner talked to me. And then he said, she's right. And then it happened really fast. Like in a week, it went boom, boom, boom. And I'm like, whoa. This was like, okay, I'm making a movie with a real director, and I love film. So it was like, whoa for me, you know, like, Werner Herzog, whoa. So just glad to meet him, and he was compassionate, and he understood where we came from, and he understood what we're going through, and he understood my efforts and what I'm trying to do.
This sounds like it's been a long journey for you since the accident, advocating for texting and driving laws. What did you draw upon to be able to get out there and get this message out to the community?
Well, you're talking to me. You can tell that it's anger. Anger has driven me from one part of this to from one step to the next step to the next step. I mean, I'm not some lady driving down the street screaming irate, hey, stop texting on your phone, you meathead. You know, I'm driving down the street and I'm thinking to myself every time I see someone texting and still driving after all of the work that we're doing, after all of our efforts, how can they still be doing this? You know, and that just encourages me to keep going and keep up the fight and keep up the struggle.
Were you surprised when the documentary went viral?
Shocked. And I'll say it to you like that. I mean, it's well over 2.3 million hits on YouTube right now. And I thought to myself, when I saw 100,000, I was like, whoa! I'm like, 2.2 million? Right!
Why do you think this documentary struck a chord with so many people?
I don't know if it's guilt on some folks' behalf, because, oh my God, that's me all day, you know, texting while their, like, head is in their lap, and, you know, and they're getting in that last text or whatever, or this happened to a family member or a friend or someone of that nature.
Do you think this could be the start of a turning point in the national conversation about texting and driving?
Well, I have to tell you that this morning I went on my way to breakfast. I saw 6 people texting, at least 7 or 8 people dialing and then talking on their phones. That was only a 10-minute ride. So I don't know about things changing. I don't know about things changing for, but we get a lot of positive feedback. And I'm hoping that those people who give us feedback are saying, okay, listen, I guess I'm not going to do this no more. And then they'll tell 2 friends and so on and so on and so on. And I'm hoping that that's what happens with us here. I'm hoping that 2 people say, okay, I'm not going to text and drive no more. And then get in the passenger seat with a friend. And the friend whips out the phone and is like, I'm not going to ride with you if that's what you're going to do. And I need it to happen that way, because I feel like then that wave will get stronger and stronger and stronger. And then maybe we'll have a tsunami of people who are not texting and driving anymore.
What do you think needs to happen in terms of legislation and also in terms of the consequences of texting and driving?
First of all, I like to have everybody in the house watch the film. Every freshman class of the house should have to be required to see it. And then maybe those states that don't have the law will get the law, because then they'll see that this is just, it's absurd. It's ridiculous that you know, the same exact way that they changed the laws with the no drinking and driving, I think that they should all just get together, spend that extra $20 on the drawing board, and get it done. I'd love to have a good half an hour with the house. You know, I mean, I think that maybe I could change at least 40 minds.
What do you hope for X going forward?
That he becomes and remains a productive kid and gets to enjoy the rest of childhood. That we have him for a long time. That the injuries don't take over his body.
Well, Valetta Bradford, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much for talking with us today.
Milwaukee mother Valetta Bradford and her 8-year-old son Xavier are featured in the new documentary From One Second to the Next, directed by Werner Herzog. It's part of the It Can Wait campaign against texting and driving, which has over 2 million hits on YouTube. They spoke with Stephanie Lecce from their Milwaukee home. The film was commissioned by AT&T, which also spearheaded the national campaign that's since been joined by several other mobile carriers. AT&T Wisconsin State President Scott Vandersanden says the company has been campaigning against texting and driving for years. He tells Lake Effect Stephanie Lecce more about its efforts.
It's a very serious issue, in so much as there's an awful lot of folks that are doing it, and obviously, you know, the telecommunications companies are the ones whose service they're using to do it. So I think we want to reach out to our customers and make sure they understand the dangers and use our products as safely as they can.
When did AT&T first get involved in this issue? When did it really come to a head that the company said, you know what, we need to step up, we need to get this message out there too?
You know, we really started what I would call our campaign in 2009 here in Wisconsin and across the nation. We've been, ever since then, working kind of as AT&T alone. Just recently, in the past 6 months or so, it's taken on all the other wireless providers have gotten involved, and it's, you know, I think we now call it more of a movement. So I think it's taken on a little bit bigger scale. But AT&T's been involved, like I said, since 2009.
So tell me about this documentary and how AT&T got involved in creating this project that really has gone viral.
Really, the objective here is to find a medium that can have an impact on audiences. Video is a pretty impactful medium. And, you know, the most recent documentary by Werner Herzog does, like I said, a very nice job of making it personal. It's a pretty hard documentary, actually, to watch. But, you know, if you're somebody that today texts and drives and watches that video, I think it would be pretty hard to continue doing that without actually thinking about it.
Tell me about the other efforts that AT&T is taking on to try to prevent texting and driving in young drivers.
We've been for a number of years now going around the state. We've partnered with AAA and the Wisconsin State Patrol. And what we basically do is we reach out to high schools and make available to them really three things. We make available to them a showing of the last text, which is what I would call the predecessor to the current documentary. We have usually a driving simulator available, and then we have a number of folks get up and speak about the dangers of texting and driving. We have targeted high schools and particularly juniors or sophomores as they're just beginning to drive. The reason for that, from our perspective, is the statistics are pretty telling, but the most notable one is teenagers are five times more likely to text than an adult, and frankly, anybody who's texting is 23 times more likely to be in an accident than somebody who isn't. So, you know, that in combination with the fact that they're also inexperienced drivers, it was our thought that we could have the biggest impact with that audience most immediately. So we've done about 25 high schools around the state. I think we've covered up about 16 or 17,000 students. You know, what I've been asked before, one of the things that's hard for us to know is, you know, when you show the documentary, either this one or its predecessor, we've done that to about 25 schools across Wisconsin, high schools. And, you know, how big an impact do you get people to actually do that, and do they follow on to it? That's a very hard thing for us to track. You know, and I hope it has an impact. Like I said, we've been doing this for a number of years, and we have, I guess we're going to relaunch, maybe is the best way to say it, or re-energize again on September 19th here in Wisconsin. We're having events in Waukesha and La Crosse, and that'll, in essence, be the kickoff of our campaign for the next 6 to 9 months.
Is that frustrating to not know exactly how many young people are taking this pledge?
I wouldn't say it's frustrating. I think the message resonates. It's very hard, in my opinion, to watch these videos. I'm a parent. You know, you watch the video, and the stories obviously pull at your heartstrings. So, you know, it's a very difficult thing to watch. You know, in a perfect world, you'd like everybody to say they're never going to do it again. That may not be realistic. I think the combination of the state law and these efforts, and a number of other efforts, AAA and the State Patrol do this on their own as well. So there's any number of initiatives trying to raise awareness around this issue.
What would you like to see happen next?
I mean, what I would like to see is keep the awareness going, keep, you know, do what you can, do what we can and others can to get as many people to take the pledge that they will not text and drive, and have it be the sort of thing that, particularly amongst the young drivers, you know, peer pressure starts working in our favor, if you will, that, you know, the driver of the car, if they go to text and drive somebody in the car, you know, applies pressure that they don't, or offers to do it, you know, offers to do it for the driver. Things along those lines would be an indication that we're making a positive impact.
Well, Scott Vandersanden, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Well, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Scott Vandersanden is the AT&T Wisconsin state president. The company commissioned the documentary From One Second to the Next and spearheaded the It Can Wait national campaign. The company is calling on people to pledge not to text and drive on its Drive for Pledges Day, September 19th. Wisconsin writer Kathy Giorgio writes an unexpected sequel to a previous novel. We'll learn about it when Lake Effect returns on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich. Are some people just born evil, or does our world and what we encounter in life turn us evil? Philosophers, writers, religious scholars, and psychologists have pondered just those questions. And they're at the heart of Waukesha writer Kathy Giorgio's latest novel, Learning to Tell a Lifetime. It's the follow-up to her award-winning 2011 book, The Home for Wayward Clocks. In that first story, abused and neglected teen Cooley finds care, compassion, and friendship from an isolated old man named James, who incidentally runs a clock museum. Giorgio tells Lake Effect Stephanie Lecce she hadn't intended to write a sequel to Cooley's initial story.
No. And in fact, during the book tour for The Home for Wayward Clocks, I was asked all the time, are you going to do a sequel? And I said, absolutely not. Because it took me 3 years to write the clock book. It took me 3 years to sell it. So I'd been out of it for a very, very long time. This book is an accidental book. I was at a warm stone massage. And I was actually 176 pages into another book that I was writing, so I had no thought of doing anything. And I'm laying there on the massage table. I'm totally blissed out. I'm face down. And all of a sudden, the opening line, Cooley never expected to cry when her mother died, came across my eyes. And I swore. And the massage therapist said, what? Did I hurt you? And I said, no, I have to go home and write a book. And by the time the therapy or the massage therapy was done, I knew it was 16 years later. I knew Cooley was 32. I knew James had passed away. He was not going to be a part of this book. I knew that Ione was in a progressive type home, which starts with assisted living and then goes to a nursing home. And I knew that her mother had just died. And that's all I knew. But it was enough to go home and start working on it.
As an author, were you afraid to disturb where you had left these characters? I mean, at the end of The Home for Wayward Clocks, we kind of have a sweet ending mm-hmm. with Cooley going to live with James and that relationship really blossoming. But instead of just leaving them there in that kind of permanent, happy place, you go ahead and you write this book, dredging up Cooley's...
All sorts of stuff.
All sorts of things.
I was scared. Partly because, number one, it seems when people read a sequel, they always say, oh, it was pretty good, but the first one was better. And I absolutely don't want that to happen, which is why I think the sequel stands on its own. You do not have to read The Home for Wayward Clocks in order to read this book. But it was also the idea in my head was that we have James in The Home for Wayward Clocks who had a severely abused childhood and who reacted to it by becoming completely isolated from the world. Then as I wrote this book, I discovered Cooley's mother had also a pretty bad background, different from James, but still a rough background. And her way of dealing with it was to start abusing Cooley. And now here's Cooley, who has been raised by this woman and saved by James. And I was like, there has to be one more step. There has to be a step to show that you can step away from that kind of background and live a completely normal life. And so I had to go back and write about her.
Now, as Cooley begins to learn about her mother and her mother's past in a way that she'd never been interested, inclined to learn about before, given that she was abused at the hands of her mother, we begin to learn what her mother experienced.
Right.
Are we meant to like her, to forgive her for what she's done to Cooley?
You are not meant to forgive her. You know, you are meant to learn how this could happen. How could a woman become someone who could burn her child with cigarettes? And, I mean, when I started to write this book, that wasn't even my intention. When I did the clock book, Cooley's mother was Cooley's mother. She didn't even have a name. She was just somebody who burned her child with cigarettes and who was an alcoholic. When I started this book and I knew I wanted the short stories to be concerning her mother, I didn't expect to like her. I didn't expect to feel for her. But I did as the story started to come out. It's really my first time writing from the abusive mind as opposed to the abused mind. And I learned so much about this in that she was a person. She was a child. And she was not born evil. She is not a monster. She became a monster. And things happened to her to lead her down that path. And I think that's what I'm trying to show more than anything, is that whenever we have bad things happen in our country, our first response is, oh, that's evil. And we point fingers and we say that person is evil. That person isn't evil. That person maybe became evil, but certainly wasn't born that way. And we need to know more about how did we get from here to there? How did this person become that way? Because we can dole out all the punishment we want. That's only going to stop that person. It's not going to keep the next person from developing that way.
That's interesting you say that. Do you have particular events in mind that you're referring to?
You know, especially while I was writing it, we had a lot of things happen in this country. We had the man who went in and shot up the movie theater. We had Sandy Hook. We had the Boston Marathon kids. We now have Castro with keeping the three women kidnapped. And just
and
a couple
Sikh temple shooting right here in our own backyard.
Yes. And just recently, just 2 weeks ago, when Castro was put into prison for life for doing this, he made a statement that said, "You're making me look like a monster. I'm not a monster. I'm sick." And everybody was very horrified at that statement. And in fact, both are true. He is sick and he became a monster. They aren't mutually exclusive. And I hope what will happen with him in prison now for life is that there will be a whole lot of talking going on to figure out, how did this man wake up one morning and decide to do this? Something made him turn left instead of going right. And in this book, too, something made Mara Rose on. I wrote the chapter about the very first time she burns Cooley. Hardest chapter of the book to write, because at that point, I knew this character really well, and I so wanted her not to do it. I wanted her to save herself. I couldn't do that. You know, I had to kind of stick with the first book, but I had to make her go through with it and watch her do it and realize this is where she makes her big mistake. This is where the mind bends and she starts to go down that path instead of staying on the straight and narrow.
You juxtapose two scenes, one a rape scene, one a scene of statutory rape, molestation. And in the first book, you had written so much about physical abuse. Is it different to write about sexual abuse versus physical abuse?
I think it is. What I found the most compelling as I wrote this book, and I did a lot of research with this. I visited therapy groups that were dealing with people who had childhood sexual abuse. And one of the things that I think everybody finds the hardest to understand and to believe is that often that person doesn't hate the person that did it to them. There is a feeling of love for this person. There's a feeling, in a lot of cases, of gratitude. And that was certainly the case with Mara Rose. She was neglected by her mother. But here was this neighbor man who stepped forward and was lavishing all sorts of attention on her. And she loved him. She wanted to grow up and marry him. And it wasn't until much later that she realized the relationship was bad. The relationship was one that never, ever should have happened. And that's so hard for people to understand. And you'll never see it on a Lifetime TV movie, having an abused victim come forward and say, "But I loved my abuser. I really wanted to be with my abuser." Because you don't think of it as abuse when you're a kid.
Do you think you were able at first to really understand?
No. I think I understood it as I wrote the book and got more into it and got into that head. And, you know, I juxtaposed the two. In Mara Rose's case, she always wants to get back to that man. She always wants to be with him. She wishes – he ends up dying in the book. She wonders what would have happened if she had made it to 18 and they were able to have a legal relationship. She always refers back to that as being – something she misses. In Cooley's case, she gets seduced by an internet stalker who she thinks is a young boy who is 1 year older than she is. Turns out he's a much older man and he rapes her. But in her mind, she still thinks of that boy that she knew on the internet. It's very hard for her to separate the two. And she still misses him. Even though he ended up not being who he was supposed to be, in her mind, she misses that boy.
You know, these days in movies and television, even books, we see a lot of violence against women depicted. And it's not always handled with the best of care. But in this case, in your book, you seem like you have a bigger mission in mind by using those elements to reach out to your readers in a certain way.
I guess I'm trying to do so much, I think, in this book, in that what I started out with, talking about how I want to show that there isn't just good and evil, that there is all of these things in between. I do get frustrated whenever there is a big news event, because it seems like as soon as we say that person was evil, it's like we're removing responsibility from ourselves as well. We couldn't possibly have changed that. We couldn't have seen that coming. We couldn't have stepped in and stopped these things from happening. That person was evil. There was no stopping them. I'd like to stop that. You know, I think there is a way of stepping in and preventing these things. In Cooley's case, you know, I can remember back in, I was a teenager, it was probably around 1976, was when the first statistics came forward that if you were abused, you were likely to become an abuser. And I remember even thinking at the time, man, that must feel like a life sentence. Not only have you been abused, but you're going to grow up to hurt other people too. There are boatloads of people out there who have been in abusive situations who have not gone on to hurt other people. We need to know why. You know, why do some people continue that chain? Why do they lose control and go ahead and keep this thing going where others will step out of that same situation and stop and be able to stop it? The more we learn about that, the more we can make it stop right away rather than continuing the whole thing.
Well, Kathy Giorgio, thank you so much for coming in and telling us about Learning to Tell a Lifetime.
Thank you.
Kathy Giorgio is the author of the novel Learning to Tell a Lifetime, which just came out this month. It's a sequel to her first novel, The Home for Wayward Clocks. Giorgio will be the keynote speaker at the 2013 Southeast Wisconsin Festival of Books on Friday. In the interest of full disclosure, Stephanie Lecce will be doing an onstage interview with Giorgio at that event. She talked with her for this interview as well. You can find more of their conversation at WUWM.com. One last break, and then we'll go on stage with alt-country pioneers, the Old 97s. That's when Lake Effect returns on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. The genre known as alt-country goes in and out of fashion with some regularity. Right now, it is in fashion. Witness the thousands of people who turned out in Milwaukee earlier this month for a concert by the group Mumford & Sons. The Texas-based Old 97s have been plying their trade through numerous cycles of the alt-country roller coaster. They've tasted major label success, starting with their 1997 album Too Far to Care, but are just as comfortable reaching their fans with literate pop songs on indie label releases as well. The group, Rhett Miller, Murray Hammond, Ken Bethay, and Philip Peoples join me on stage before a concert at Turner Hall this summer for an interview. We need to come clean here. They played a couple of songs for us, which came through the mixing board at a level that was just a little too, well, let's say a lot too distorted for us to use. We will feature one of the songs in the middle of the interview, mixed together with the original studio version. We're not trying to pull a fast one on you. With that said, let's go on stage to Turner Hall.
Old 97s, Rhett, Murray, Ken, Philip, welcome to Milwaukee.
Hi, Mitch. Nice to see you again.
Hey, it's great to see you. Thanks so much for being with us.
We're glad to be here, Mitch.
And you are not too far removed from the anniversary tour for Too Far to Care, your breakthrough with Elektra. A lot of people look at the history of Old 97s in terms of dividing lines. Do you look at it in terms of everything before Too Far to Care and everything afterwards?
No, I see it as a continuum. I think we all kind of do. Just we've been experiencing this crazy thing for 20 years this year. It's our 20th anniversary as a band, but yeah, I've never, I don't know. Too Far was awesome, but I never felt like it was some big weird
mark. If anything, Too Far On is more together, because the first two albums, we just didn't, you know, we're making records with zero money, and so like, even on the guitars, the overdub and stuff was very minimal. I mean, it was none on the first record, 2 hours for 17 songs. Since Too Far, we at least had, you know, a budget and enough time to sit and, you know, talk out and hash out what you're trying to do here, rather than just go, well, it was in tune, it wasn't a horrible performance, therefore, right, let's put it on the record.
The music industry was a different place when you guys got into it. Not that I imagine it was easy, but as an outsider, it seems like there were more opportunities to find your way to a big label in those days. And maybe this is an impossible question to answer, but do you feel like you were fortunate to have come into your own when you did?
We got to ride the last of that wave, and we got to see why that business model failed. You know,
yeah, we saw it going away. We saw the kind of money that just flew out the window.
Crazy. From the label. Stupid.
Spent too much money on bands like us feeding us fancy steaks. And
we had 15 record labels flying us around one whole summer trying to get us to sign to their label. And just the money they spent on that. Forget about the records.
It's crazy.
It's so wasted.
I saw Seymour Stein fly to Oslo, Norway to eat a particular salmon dish.
With us.
Had at this particular restaurant where we happen to be playing next to or something. You know.
It was crazy. And then the record budgets, that was the coolest part for us, was we got to spend $250,000 of pop to make records, and nobody needs to do that. That does not make sense.
It turns out it cost a lot less.
And that was in 1997 money. That's like $1 billion now.
Well, we knew it cost a lot less to make a record, but we didn't want to tell them because don't tell them how much it actually could cost.
Well, and
$2,500.
Yeah. Well, and today you know share the bill with groups that you know are coming into a different industry than you did, and you know is it at all hard to watch how hard it is to break through now?
I feel a little bit bad, but it was hard to break through back then. But you could break through to a thing that was just filled with money. You know, now you break through and you're lucky to break through to a niche. You know, and like we're playing a bunch of shows coming up with Trapper Shep and the Shades, and they're great. And you know, they've inherited a world that was ruined by the likes of, I don't know, I don't want to name names, Phil Collins, whoever.
I don't know who ruined it.
Whoever was really bad, they spent a lot of money to make them really famous, and everybody got mad and decided music should be free, and now it is.
I want to ask you about the alt-country label. The standard line about alt-country is that it shifts between being the next big thing and the last big thing. Does it matter that it seems like it's a moving target, or do you feel like you can just do what you do, and if alt-country shifts to be in when you're playing, it's great, and if not, then so be it?
You just do what you
do. Do what you do, without question.
We never thought about that you get asked about it in interviews, and so then you have to formulate an opinion. But beyond that, every once in a while I go, oh, wait, there's all these bands on the Grammys with banjos and acoustic guitars.
There was nothing more shocking than Mumford & Sons and Avett Brothers and Lumineers and all that. But at the same time, you just go, well, we don't really sound like them either, you know. Yeah. We don't have derbies or anything.
Yeah. So. You know what? They figured out how to have a hit.
Yeah,
I don't think we ever figured it out.
We figured out how to have a career.
We have a new song. You want to hear it?
we you know what? We figured out how to do that. Probably many of those bands will see that. Time will tell. We figured out how to stay around for 20 years, and we'll probably figure out how to stay around for 30 and 40 years. 40 years if we eat well, guys.
Yes, we're either halfway through a healthy life.
At you.
I hear there is soup backstage.
Ah, nice.
Well, oh, boo.
And salad.
Well, this would be as good a time as any to have you play something else. What do you got for us?
Well, you know exactly what we're going to play because you requested it, Mitch. This is a little song called Jagged.
give it a try. There's no settling down, there's only driving down the state. So I drive.
From Fight Songs, old 97s in Milwaukee with us. This seems like a strange question to ask coming out of that song, but are the four of you generally happy or comfortable at this point?
Yeah.
Yeah. We've always been happy and comfortable. I mean, in life?
Yeah, in life. I mean, I wonder if contentment is a challenging place for music to come from, because Jagged is not a song of... you know, contentment.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know,
songs come from funny places. I mean, that song, I had a music supervisor from a movie, Don Was, who's also a producer, who actually almost produced Too Far to Care till the Stones made him get in the studio to do Steel Wheels. But he gave me a video, little footage of Vince Vaughn driving down a highway that was going to be from a movie called Hope Floats. And he goes, write a song that would sound good over that. And I remember I was in my girlfriend in L.A.'s, she had a lunchbox, and it was the Remains of the Day, that movie, the period piece movie, Remains of the Day. So I was looking up at the Remains of the Day lunchbox, and I thought, what remains of the day remains to be seen? I just wrote a song. So I wasn't particularly miserable that day either, but we are very happy, and I still write songs that are kind of miserable. So.
I have a question. Remains of the Day lunchbox.
That's exactly. That's the funny of it.
I would like to have that little girl or boy that has that. They'd be a reader. They'd be a reader. Wow.
The Jane Austen lunchbox collection would be pretty popular.
That's right.
It is. It just sounds like a Zach Galifianakis.
I don't know why my son keeps getting beat up. I keep packing him his lunch in his Pride and Prejudice lunchbox.
You'd have to make a pretty good lunch to live up to it, too. I want to ask this in particular to Murray and Rhett, because you each have this solo work under your belt. How does that kind of work that is under your own direction affect how you work when you're working with kind of a shared artistic vision? I mean, is it like the difference between writing a short story and writing a novel, or is it like two completely different things?
That's more of a question for Rhett. My little solo stuff is more of a hobby. And so it has the dynamics of a hobby. And I'm talking like stamp collecting, those kind of things. So, Rhett,
so modest.
I want to divert to you.
For me, it makes it really easy to be a member of a democracy, which is this band has always been straight up, you know, equals. And every once in a while, it can get frustrating, like if I have a bunch of songs that they're not into, which was the case... you know, which is why I started making solo records to begin with. So it's great. It makes me miss them. If I'm out on the road by myself, I go, God, I love to rock out, and I miss these guys. And then, of course, we're out on the road for 6 weeks, and I go, geez, I really want to be back by myself for five freaking minutes.
The pendulum just keeps swinging.
Exactly.
There is a lot of give and take between your fans. I mean, you have a forum for them hosted on your website. I wonder, is it important to you to make a community out of your music?
I didn't know we had a forum.
Yeah, you know, that's one of the more pleasant aspects of a band, I think, is that a real community and all of its little offshoots forms around it. Yeah, you know?
I do feel that. I feel like there's an old 97s kind of community. I get it on Twitter. I know you guys pay more attention to Facebook than I do, but at the shows and stuff, you see it's the same faces, and they bring new people, and those people become part of that group.
Yeah, I don't have much on this subject. It's fun. Yeah, it's nice. Right.
Well, I guess, one more question for you, and I'll ask this because my 5-year-old is along with us today. Hi, Charlie. Yeah.
He's so cute, too.
Well, and someday someone will ask him what he was listening to when he was 5 or 6, and he will say old 97s and the Beatles, not necessarily in that order.
Nah,
but
okay.
what were the bands that grabbed you when you were the youngest?
Murray, why don't you
say? The Beatles. Yeah, I'm like you, Charlie. I'm a old Beatles and Johnny Cash fan. When I was your age, my first record I ever owned was Live at San Quentin by Johnny Cash. And then immediately after that was Revolver.
Cool. My parents got me into folk music, so I grew up listening to the Kingston Trio and Bob Dylan a lot, and then later got into the rock and roll and became a big Bowie fan and Kinks and all that kind of stuff.
My dad was a high school football coach, so music was very close to being outlawed because it wasn't football. But my sister got an 8-track tape player, and she had a Osmonds and a Partridge Family. And so while Murray thinks it's really cool to name drop Sam Quentin, I'm proud of my Osmonds and Partridge Family background. Listen to Your Heartbeat is a great Partridge Family song. You'd look it up. It's better than Johnny Cash, I can tell you that.
My parents were married really young, and they enjoyed a lot of popular music from the 60s and 70s. So I grew up listening to everything they listened to, which ranged from Bob Dylan to Waylon Jennings to the Beatles to they threw a lot of parties when I was young. I heard lots of great music growing up.
Well, and I know at least some of you have kids at home.
All of us.
All of you? Yeah. So they're all listening to old 97s, correct?
All the
time. My son's going to see Cheap Trick tomorrow night. So there you go.
Well, on that note, Philip, Ken, Rhett, Murray, it has been a blast. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Mitch. Take care, man.
All right, take care.
Woo! I got a check for nothing. All made out to someone. I truly love myself.
Texas-based Old 97s are Rhett Miller, Murray Hammond, Ken Bethay, and Philip Peoples. We spoke with them on stage at Turner Hall earlier this summer. Rhett Miller is back in town tomorrow for a solo show at Shank Hall. Lake Effect alum Trapper Shep opens that show. There's another in-studio performance on tomorrow's show. We'll meet the British folk rockers the Dunwells, plus a conversation with Steve Marcus about his vision for the downtown Milwaukee of the future. I'm Mitch Tyke. Thank you so much for being with us today. I sure hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect from WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. We're NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh air is next. It's 11 o'clock.